Can you believe it? Dreamers Podcast is turning 1 year old on May 16th. To celebrate, I am hosting a live online event May 16th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For all the details, go to howtodream.co/year. I hope to raise lots of money for Give Kids the World charity and make a lot of fun memories. See you then.
This is the Dreamers Podcast, where dreamers share their stories to inspire you. Now, join host Joe Pardo as he interviews a dreamer who's living their dreams.
Hey Dreamers, I'm Joe Pardo, and today I'm talking with Callum Lang, who is making his dreams come true by building, buying, and selling businesses in Asia. Glad to have you on the show, Callum.
I'm glad to be here, Joe. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, I am as well. You know, a good friend of mine, Tyo Roxon, is the one, and he's been on the show, as my listeners know, like about four times. He's in that elite club of guests and interviewees I've had that have been on the show multiple times, and he connected us together because he thought you would be a great fit for my show.
Yeah, that was very kind of him. I had a lot of fun talking to Tayo on his podcast, and I also introduced him to a lot of other expatriate and third generation entrepreneurs that are around the world that resonated with the stuff he's doing. So yeah, it was good. It's not very kind of him to put me in touch with you.
Yeah, it was very. I'm so thankful for that. Callum, why don't we get started by giving some background about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So, I guess the reason that Tayo was interested is because my background is a little bit confused. But so I was born in New Zealand, grew up in the UK, and I've been in Asia for coming up to 14 years now. So quite confused. And I always say that the New Zealand accent still comes out, but normally only when I'm watching rugby.
Rugby. is that, you know, that's actually a sport I haven't watched. I have watched Australian football. Does that get televised over there in Asia?
A little bit. It's Aussie rules football is pretty niche. So I think if you're in the Aussie bars, you can normally find it, but not too much beyond that.
That sport is pretty crazy. I only get to watch it every once in a while because it'll be on TV at like 1 a.m.
Yeah, that's about right.
So why don't you give some background about how you got involved with buying and selling businesses in Asia?
Yeah, sure. So I'd always been, as a kid, I'd always been pretty entrepreneurial, just as a way of trying to make, you know, some additional cash. So I guess my first business was washing cars around the neighborhood, and then graduated up from that and set up my own little ice cream business, which was quite profitable at the time. It was back in the early 80s, and somebody had given me a copy of Ben and Jerry's recipe book, and it was before quality ice creams had really hit the UK. So I was making nice homemade ice cream when everybody else was eating the kind of the yellow fizzy stuff. So that was quite a successful venture for a while. I was supplying pubs and restaurants around my hometown of Cambridge with this homemade ice cream. So that was a good little entrepreneurial venture. And then kind of kept growing for that, sort of dabbled around in a few other bits and pieces, went to university and was lucky enough to fall out of university into the dot-com boom. And I was working for an internet company in Amsterdam in Holland. And it was, you know, it was dot-com boom time. So it was a pretty exciting time to be around and to be in the internet industry. And so myself and another guy set up a consultancy business, a consultancy and recruitment business, which was my first sort of grown up entrepreneurial venture. And we were very successful, which at the age of, I guess I was 20, 23, 24 at that point, I thought the success was purely down to my own unique talents and skills. And then the dot-com bubble burst and I discovered that actually I hadn't been that talented at all. I'd just been in the right place at the right time. But by then I'd sort of caught the bug for entrepreneurialism. And kept going, and shortly after that came out to Asia, which was really just because I was looking at, you know, all of the big macro trends that were happening, and you know, there was obvious trends like aging populations throughout the world, and but one of the biggest trends was just the shift in wealth from the West to the East. And I was just really interested in all of the stuff that was happening in Asia, and moved over here. And like I said, about 13, 14 years ago. And it's just it's a fantastic place to be as an entrepreneur, because I think entrepreneurs tend to do their best when there's a very dynamic marketplace. We make our money when there's big shifts in value, and before everyone else catches up. And when you've got a situation like we have in Asia, with, you know, just massive shifts happening, from, you know, the shift from rural communities to urban communities, the massive shifts that are happening with technology, and you've got countries like Malaysia, which is sort of the next door neighbor of Singapore, where 30% of Malaysians have only ever accessed the internet through their mobile phones. You've got countries like Singapore, like South Korea, that are considered mobile first countries. So, you know, over 100% penetration of smartphones. So there's just a lot of incredible stuff going on here, and that makes it a very exciting place to be an entrepreneur. And so I came out here and sort of jumped in with both feet, not really knowing what I was doing. As most entrepreneurs did, I made lots and lots of very silly mistakes. But I've been lucky enough to have a bit of success along the way, and so that's contributed to me now having bought and sold about half a dozen different companies. Including the last company that I started is a company called Fitness Buffet, which provides fitness and wellness services to corporations. So we're now in 12 countries around the world. But actually most of what I do now on a day-to-day basis is actually working with either small business owners, helping them to raise their own visibility and value in the marketplace through a company called Key Person of Influence. And also working with another guy called Jeremy Harbour to help small business owners exit at higher valuations than perhaps they would do normally. So we're in the process of rolling up some companies and IPOing them. And it's just a lot of fun. A lot of fun if you're an entrepreneur geek, as I suppose I am.
Now, when you got out to Asia, was there a barrier for you, like language-wise and just culture-wise?
Yeah, there was. The first country I landed in was Thailand, and obviously I didn't speak Thai when I arrived, and didn't speak much more when I left, to be honest. in most places the language of business is still English, so. As long as I had a good PA that could help me through, I was normally did okay. Yeah, I mean, culturally, yeah, there was some big shocks, and took quite a bit of. I'm not sure whether it's learning or whether it's unlearning. I think there was quite a lot of unlearning. Whatever you grow up with, you assume is the best way of doing things, and then. When you go into a new culture and they do things differently, it's easy to assume that they're doing it wrong. So I think I had to do quite a lot of unlearning before I could actually start to progress. But having done that, so It's one of those big misnomers when you say moving to Asia. Asia is such a diverse place, and every country within it is so diverse. So, yeah, a big part of it is learning how to do business in each of the territories that you're working in. But overall, if you're kind of open to exploring and having fun and being curious, it's been a good ride. It's been fun.
What was some of the first steps you took once you got out to Asia, into Thailand?
So I was kind of, I guess, very, very lucky in a lot of ways. We landed in Thailand with my girlfriend, now wife, and she had got a teaching job. So your wife's a teacher. She had a teaching job in Thailand. And I kind of just assumed that with the qualifications that I'd got and the experience I've got, I could just walk into a job. I was being offered lots of jobs in Europe, and I assumed that I could do something similar in Thailand. And turned out that wasn't the case. And so, for the first time in my life, I'd lost my network. So not only did I not know anyone in Thailand, even the people that I did know back in Europe were all on a completely different time zone. So it wasn't really like I could just pick up the phone to them, and none of them knew anyone in Asia either. So for the first time in my life, I had to start going to business networking events. And I went along, as I think many people do, to their first networking events. I kind of stood in the corner and got drunk on my own and didn't actually meet anyone that interesting, but became sort of intrigued looking at the people there that were very good at networking, had very well established networks, and just decided that I wanted to build a network. I wanted to have the networks that these very senior guys had, and I could see the way they interact. I could see the way they could pull deals together very quickly just by calling a few people they knew. And I thought, yeah, I want that network. I just don't want to wait until I'm 60 years old like these guys. So I started sort of studying anyone that I could that had a great network, and trying to figure out how do you create enough value in the world that people will want to be in your network. And so that sort of became a bit of a sideline obsession for me, and it ultimately spun out into one of my first businesses. Because what I realized over time was, actually, if you run your own networking events, then you basically win. So not only do you get the whole database for the evening, you don't have to run around trying to collect business cards, you get the whole database, but people will pay to attend, sponsors will pay to sponsor. But more importantly, what I realized is, if you run your own networking event, everyone assumes that you know everyone. And so what happens is, they'll come to you and say, look, I've got a new opportunity. I'm looking for investment in this company, or I've got a new opportunity. I'm thinking of launching this product into this country. Who would you, who should I talk to? And obviously, like, of all the opportunities that start to flow to you, 99% of them are not relevant for you. And so you just push them back into your network. And the more opportunities you're pushing into your network, the more people want to be in your network. So it sort of becomes an upward spiral of value. But of course, as well as that, you also get a few opportunities that are just perfect for you. And so you can kind of jump onto them. So yeah, that was sort of one of my big early learnings, and ultimately turned that into a business, which we grew into 7 countries, 36 networks, and then I ended up selling that to a training company, but retaining a lot of the intellectual property, which has sort of stayed with me ever since.
No, I love the idea of building the network through, hosting your own events, or and sometimes just, even when you're just getting started, I've noticed going to events and just getting your face out there to begin with, especially if you're in a new area, can help. And then all of a sudden you have all these business cards, and then all of a sudden you have the emails, and then you can start hosting your own events. And like you said, the perception becomes reality that, hey, if you're hosting this, then you must know pretty much everybody here, because you're the guy, you're the host.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't you know, I make it sound easy. The first, I remember sitting with a guy I knew, a Danish guy that was there, and saying, look, you know, I think I've figured this game out. I think if we host our own networking event, then, you know, people will pay to come and sponsors will pay. And, you know, we're just onto a winner here. And so he said, well, look, that sounds good. I'll do that with you. So we decided to run a weekly breakfast meeting. That was our first networking event. And I said, look, let's plan for worst case. So let's plan for worst case is that nobody shows up. So let's just run this for 6 months. And me and you, once a week, we'll have breakfast together. And that's the worst case. Are you okay with that? And he's like, yep, happy to do that. So we sent out to our respective networks and said, look, we're starting this business breakfast. The first week came, and me and Tim sat there and ate breakfast on our own. Not a single person showed up. And the second week, even Tim didn't show up. So I was just on my own. And I was like, right, something's not working with our marketing here. So kept tweaking, kept changing. And the following week, we had a few more people. And the following week, a few more. And gradually built it up. And it just evolved and evolved. And I ended up running. So I had the business breakfast, which kind of got a little following. And then we launched something called Bangkok Young Professionals, which I believe is still going to this day. It was one of the biggest networking events of its time. And we just targeted kind of the younger generation of entrepreneurs, because that's what we were at the time. And that's, you know, the older generation didn't seem that interested in meeting youngsters. So we just set up our own one. And then when that became, you know, we were having like 200 plus people a month coming along to that event and making good money from sponsors. And then suddenly all these older people that had ignored us before wanted to know whether they were young enough to be allowed into our event. So it was interesting how it built momentum, but it was a great experience for me and a great way to build my personal network at the beginning, which sort of has stayed with me ever since, fortunately.
You know, I love the idea of taking what basically are the outcasts and turning it into a network and a bunch of friends that band together, that they become so big that they can't be ignored.
Yeah. No, I'm not sure how much strategy there was to it at the time. It just seemed like a fun thing to do. It worked very well. And I think generally, what I've sort of learned from that process and ever onward is that just like you do, if you can create value for people in your network, then everything kind of flows from that. So it was always, you know, how can we create more value for the people in the network? How can we do better sponsorship deals so that they get, you know, better door prizes, or you know, we can connect them. We actually sort of take time to connect them to people in the network that they should be meeting, or how can we do deals with the media where we can feature people in our network so that they get some extra visibility. And the more value you create for your network, the more, you know, the good word spreads and more interesting people come into the network. And yeah, like I said, it just sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, really.
How did your family take it when you were like, I'm going to move to Asia and I'm going to figure it out when I get there?
I think they'd given up on me by that point. So I think my mum is still waiting for me to get a real job. I think we were, when we moved out to Asia, I guess we were, I was 26, 27. And so I think it was the general consensus was, you know, you're young, go and do it for a couple of years and then come back to England or New Zealand or somewhere and start living a normal life, which I just have never quite got round to doing.
Hey, you did get married. you know.
I did get married. That. I did get married. Yeah, I got married and kids and all that sort of stuff, but I've stayed in Asia. It would be hard, like as somebody that's sort of built and sold a few businesses, and now, you know, I'm heavily involved in the entrepreneurial scene in Asia. It would seem very strange to not be in Asia now, just because there's just so much opportunity here. I think going back to somewhere like the UK doesn't really hold too much appeal anymore.
Is that because there's so much explosion in industry and in every, like, just everything going on in Asia right now, versus like if you went back to the UK, it's just like, oh, this is just how business is done, and you know, it's the same old, if you will.
Yeah, and the weather. The weather's much better.
No one's going to blame you for that, that's for sure.
we have a very spoiled lifestyle here. It's very good. But yeah, I think, look, within a five-hour radius of Singapore, you've got pretty much half the world's population here. You've got these incredibly dynamic countries that are skipping over, you know, there's countries and villages and places where they've never had fixed line phones. They've jumped straight to mobile phones, and yet, you know, they're getting online and they're building stuff and they're creating things. And it's just a very, very, very high energy environment. And I think one of the things that we teach in the Key Person of Influence program that I run with a lot of entrepreneurs is that environment dictates performance. So if you put yourself in an environment where you've got, you know, a lot of stuff happening and you're surrounded by a lot of success, that's a very compelling and motivating environment to be in. Yeah, it also becomes quite addictive. It's kind of like when, you know, imagine if you're working at Google and you're constantly being pressed to create new products and to positively impact humanity. I imagine it's, you know, it's quite difficult to go and work, you know, for example, go and work in a manufacturing sector or somewhere where it's not quite as fast paced and dynamic. So yeah, no, it's. I think the longer you're here, the harder it is to leave.
So Callum, outside of being you know, having breakfast by yourself, what's been the biggest roadblock that you've had to overcome?
I think mostly it's a mental block, which just comes from, yes, being a slow learner. I think as an entrepreneur, you're always frustrated by lack of resources. You always think that, you know, if you could just get fundraising, like if you could just get $1 million, you'd be able to take this to the next level. Or if you could, and when you've got money, you think, well, if I could just get good staff, I'd be able to take this to the next level. And I think that the more you go through it, the more you realize that really is just a mindset thing. Actually, if you've got the right idea and you've got the ability to pitch it well, you can always pull money forward from clients. Top staff will come and work with you just because they want to be a part of the vision. So I think that the biggest roadblock I dealt with was just getting out of my own way, not obsessing too much about the limitations that I thought were there, but instead focusing on how could I attract the right clients into my life, or how could I attract the right people into the team. And I think one of the ways I've sort of got progressively better at handling that and playing that game is to find people that are already doing it, and find people that are playing the game that I want to be playing, and going and figuring out how I can create value for them. And the more I can help them, the more I get to learn from them, which just enables you to sort of go up and make progress. And I think if I look at sort of the big jumps in learning and thus success that I've had, it's always been when I've found someone that's playing one or two levels ahead of me, and I've managed to find a way to go and create value for them and almost sort of be an apprentice at their feet, just to learn from them. But that's sort of been my secret to success, if there is one.
You know, I kind of look at it like you're constantly resume building for somebody else, even though you're not trying to get hired by them. You're just trying to get recognized by them or trying to have them as a client, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was actually listening to Ryan Holiday was saying, he was on a podcast, and he was talking about how he got started, and it was pretty similar model. He sort of found Robert Greene and people and just looked at what did they need help with. So Robert Greene needed help with research, and he said, look, I'll come and work for free if I need to, but I'll help you do that research. So yeah, I've kind of taken the same approach, which is successful people are always, you know, they've always got more projects than they can handle. So if you can help them deliver on some of those projects, which otherwise would be wasted opportunities, it not only benefits them and therefore puts you in their good graces, but it's also a great opportunity to learn firsthand from them as to how they approach things and what they're working on. So what they consider high value, which is often very, very different from what I considered my high value activities. And I think that's sort of comes down to, you know, once you start to get really clear on what your high value activities are, that's where you start to make the real leaps.
No, I agree. I think that it definitely works exactly the way you're saying it, and I think anyone listening should take heed. And even if it's, you know, working in a 9-to-5 job, you know, look to see where the pain points are of the people that are above you and see what you can do to, you know, tackle those and bring value to them in other ways outside of just your normal job.
Yeah, totally agree with that in the job environment as well. I think Seth Godin, in one of his books, Lynchpin, talks about that. It's like, it doesn't matter what your job is, find that way to make yourself the linchpin for your boss. Let them take credit if they need to. But just make yourself invaluable to them. It's a good thing to do.
Callum, what was your childhood dream growing up?
It was to play football in the first division, which is now the Premiership in the UK now. So I always wanted to play football for Liverpool, and I'm still waiting for the phone call. I'm still available if they decide that they need a middle-aged man that's not that fit anymore. So that was always the goal growing up, but as I mentioned, I pretty early on jumped into various forms of entrepreneurship to start making a little bit of side income. And once I'd done that, as you do when you start to earn a little bit of money on the side, your dreams start to become around that. And yeah, I think for a long time I wanted to be a global CEO. And then in my first business, when we had offices in Amsterdam, Dublin, and London, and I spent my life on a plane going between those three cities, I discovered that actually the global CEO was fine as long as I didn't have to do loads and loads of travel. It sounded very glamorous until you find every Friday night you're sat in the departure lounge while all your friends are out partying. So it's interesting how your dreams evolve as you grow up. But yeah, still waiting for the call from Liverpool.
So with that said, what do your dreams for the future look like?
So I'm really excited about the stuff that we're doing at the moment, and I'm really excited about kind of the opportunities to work with small to mid-sized business owners. One of my friends and business colleagues is a guy called Daniel Priestley, and he'd interviewed about 5,000 business owners over the course of building the business that he's done. And he identified something that he calls the entrepreneur journey. And it's kind of, so it turns out it's fairly formulaic the way most entrepreneur journeys go. You know, startups, very exciting. The vast majority of small businesses get stuck in the next piece, which is, you know, typically one to three staff, less than $500,000 revenue. And that's where most get stuck. And then you've got a nice little business, sort of a lifestyle business between 4 and 12 staff up to a few million dollars. And then you kind of progressively go up the level. But one of the things that another mentor and now business colleague of mine, Jeremy Harbour, has realized is that even if you build yourself a very nice business and it's, you know, it's turning over a couple of million dollars a year, it's not too stressful, you've got a good team, the exit value for that company is actually pretty disappointing. Most times as a private company, you're only likely to get one or two times your profit, which sort of, if you've spent 10, 15, 20 years building up a business, it's quite disappointing to try and sell it and be told it's, you know, it's not really worth that much money. So what we're doing now is we're working with a lot of small business owners that have got those nice little businesses, and just helping them to either make some simple changes which can increase the valuation of their company, or in a lot of cases actually wrapping them up into groups of companies that we can potentially then package together and sell at a much higher valuation onto other companies or even into the public markets. So it's a lot of fun, to do. And it helps small business owners that have built great businesses, but just perhaps haven't really thought about the exit opportunity. I'm enjoying that. If I could spend the next few years working on more deals like that, I'd be pretty happy. It's good fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun getting to work with small business owners. And do you find it hard to get your foot in the door with the cold calls, or is your network so big at this point that the cold call doesn't really exist for you?
I don't really do cold calls. So I'm, like I mentioned, I'm always trying to figure out ways to add value to my existing network, and that definitely leads to a lot of referrals. Well, one of the things that I've done, this is when, you know, you have one of those great ideas and then it turns into a really silly idea, and then somehow it just keeps going anyway. So I was about 6 months ago, maybe a little bit longer, I was trying to figure out how I could create more value for the people in my network. And there were certain business owners in my network that were doing, and not just business owners, sort of some employees and companies that were just doing really cool stuff. And I thought, yeah, wouldn't it be cool if I could just interview them or find a way to shine a light on them, give them a little bit more visibility. And so I wrote off to a couple of fairly popular, fairly big websites that I've done sort of the odd bit of writing for. And I said, hey, look, would you be interested in me doing a weekly feature of people in, you know, successful people in Asia that are doing cool stuff? And I think I got 3 or 4 rejections from these sites. And then I found another site called Asian Entrepreneur. And I dropped them an email, and they came back and they said, yeah, that would be fantastic. And I looked at their website, and they had really good content, but they just didn't have much content. They didn't have as much content as you need these days to be a popular site. So just, you know, when you do those really silly things, I just dropped them a note back and I said, well, actually, I think you need more content. What about if I did a daily interview? And again, they came back and they went, yeah, that would be brilliant. And I just thought, oh, what have I just done? And so I then had to kind of figure out, and it's not like I'm sitting around with nothing to do all day. I've got a couple of businesses to run. So I then had to figure out how I could do a daily interview with business leaders in Asia. And unfortunately, I didn't have to put the time in that you do when you interview people. I could just send off a list of questions and get people to fill in the answers and send it back. But I set that up, and fortunately I've got a great team of assistants that I work with. So we set that up, and I now do and have done for about 6 months a daily interview of people in Asia and successful entrepreneurs and leaders in Asia. And of course I get each one of those to recommend three other people that they think would be worthy of getting exposure on this site. So that's been a great tool for enabling me to build my network. And of course, you know, the people, the first time they hear about me is when they get a recommendation from their friends that they should be featured on this website and interviewed by me. And they'll generally do a bit of background background research on me and see the work I'm doing. And if they're looking to, if they're looking to grow their business or they're looking for investment or exit opportunities, oftentimes they'll sort of reach out to me. So, I've been quite lucky with that, but always looking for new people with interesting businesses and seeing how I can work with them. So it's, as you know, it's a never ending game.
Yeah. I love how you went from like, oh, this sounds like a great idea to, oh crap, you actually like that idea. And that's going to be a super time suck, but you were able to figure out a way to have your assistants, you know, handle it. And I love the fact that it's text-based, so they could just fill out the answers, send it in, and then you just get someone to post it up, and exactly. No editing, other than text editing, but
yeah, I've got an editor to do that now as well. So, generally the first time I see the interview is when it's all finished up and published. That's definitely a Tim Ferriss 4-hour work week trick. That is anything that I do that is repetitive, I break down and outsource to virtual assistants. It's very useful.
Yeah, I would recommend virtual assistants to anybody who needed, had too much on their plate and needs it. I unfortunately do not have the money to pay virtual assistants yet, but I'm getting there.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about it is because I was having this conversation with a guy that's an employee, and I was looking, we were talking about how he spends his day, and there's a ton of stuff that he does that's just like it's repetitive, and he's getting a decent salary, but he's spending 30% of his time doing stuff that's really low value. And I said, well, why don't you just hire it out to a VA? And he said, well, my company would never pay for that. I said, well, you pay for it. Like, it doesn't matter. It's going to, like, a VA is, my VA is probably around $7 or $8 an hour. And all right, I'm a little bit excessive. I've got lots of them now and spend a fair amount on it, but it didn't start that way. It just started with, you know, an hour here, an hour there. But it's, for you, Joe, your high value time is in front of other business owners. It's in front of people that you could do partnerships with. And, paying someone a few dollars an hour to help get you in front of more people is probably a good investment that will pay back pretty quickly.
I would agree. that's definitely the plan once I have a way of making that regular income to make that happen. So definitely in the future, not too distant future, that's for sure.
Sure.
Callum, before you let everyone know how they can connect with you, is there any last thoughts you'd like to share?
No, I mean, look, I'm a big fan of your idea of follow your dreams. I think it's great to encourage people to do that. I think with any of that stuff, I think that the difference between it being a hollow motivational phrase and being something that you can actually turn into something that actually gets you closer to your dreams is the strategies that you use, and by listening to the great people that you get onto this podcast, that's it's great for people to see the different strategies, and I'm sure, as anyone that's a regular listener will know, that my strategy for achieving my dreams is very different from other people's strategies from achieving dreams. So yeah, there's multiple paths out there, but make sure you've got somebody that's, I guess my big learning, as I mentioned earlier, is find someone that's doing exactly what you want to be doing, and see how you can add value from them so that you can learn from them. I think one of my mentors once said, the best question that you can ask when you have an idea is who. So whereas most people would say, okay, like I want to, they come up with their dream, and then their next question is, how do I do that? Well, for most of us, we have no idea how to do it. Otherwise, we would have done it already. And if you've got no idea, you either don't do it or you kind of plow forward blindly, which can often lead to some pretty uncomfortable situations. I think a much better question is not how do I do it, but who already knows the answer to this? Who would benefit the most if I was to achieve this, and why would they help me? Who would know the answer to this question? Even if I don't know someone specifically, who do I know that might know someone? So that's a much more useful question moving forward, I think, if you're trying to figure out how to reach your dreams.
Ah, that's beautifully said. And thank you for the compliments to the show. I try to get people that are on all different scale, you know, parts of the journey, right? From the beginning to the people that have already done it and people that are still in the middle somewhere. So that so that my audience and the, you know, my dreamers out there have an easily obtainable resource. So it's not just like, oh, it's the people that already did it and came back, and it's like, okay, well, you know, they could break it down how they went about it, but it's not as obtainable. You know, it's not just one or two steps in front of them every time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we're all still trying to figure it out. Nobody's got all the answers. It's always your best thinking at the current time, and generally something comes along to slap you in the face and teach you that you don't know it all after all. And we're all still learning.
Definitely. Callum, I would love for you to share how people can connect with you.
Yeah, cool. Look, I'd love for people to connect with me. Probably the easiest is through Twitter at Lane Callum, or through my website, which is callumlaing.com. So callumlaing.com. And love to hear from your listeners.
Thank you. And I'll have both of those in the show notes for people to find them at howtodream.co.
Perfect.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show and taking the time to share all this knowledge and this network building and this you know, big dream planning and the screw ups along the way.
yeah. No, it's been a lot of fun, and I appreciate the opportunity, Joe.
Not a problem. And I'd love to have you on again in about a year to follow up and see how you've been.
Cool. I'll put it in the diary.
Awesome. 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 Well, thank you again, Cal.
Thanks, Joe. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dreamers Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Dreamers Podcast. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dreamers Podcast. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the Dreamers Podcast, please send an email to j@jpar.co. This podcast is copyright 2014 by jpar.co.
Hey Dreamers, Joe here. I really appreciate you listening to Dreamers Podcast. If you'd like to find out how to support the show, please visit howtodream.co/support for all the ways you can help out. Thanks for the support, and please keep on dreaming.